All right. Well, thank you all, and we're ready to get going here. We're just going to go in order here so everybody can just know what when they'll be up and be ready for that, right? Our first speaker at this session is Alan Carlin. He retired recently after more than 38 years as a senior analyst and manager at the U.S. EPA, where he worked both on economics and the physical science aspects of environmental pollution control. So we'll get right into this. We have four speakers in this session, so we'll keep the bios real short. You can read the rest of them, but we want to get the maximum amount of time in for each speaker. So let's help welcome Alan.
Welcome, and thanks to for the invitation to speak here. I'm proposing to cover two topics. One is the major changes that have occurred in EPA in the last year and a half. And the other one is to attempt to take a very broad view of the warmest narrative and to home in on five of the eight assumptions they make, which I think have not received as much attention as the first three. It's my hypothesis that EPA plays a extremely important role in the current effort by the warmists to reshape how the world uses energy. It is my underlying hypothesis that the rest of the world in the end, sooner or later, will not commit anything approaching suicide by agreeing to roll back the Industrial Revolution without the US being on board. It's pretty clear that, at least under the current Congress, the Senate is not likely to pass a cap and tax or even the most recent bill. So EPA appears likely to be the area where the main fight is going to occur, both in the US as well as the world. Without the Supreme Court's intervention, the warmest onslaught would probably now be history, given the rapidly declining support both in Western Europe, Australia, and here in the US. But through a series of circumstances, not only has EPA accumulated a great deal of regulatory power over its almost 40 years, but recently, a year or two ago, the Supreme Court took the step of managing to give it even more. Namely, it has conferred on it a reinterpretation of the Clean Air Act, which allows it to regulate greenhouse gases, it now appears. When I heard of all this, which was early last year, I was immediately of the view that EPA's role was crucial, and although I couldn't probably influence what the new administration was going to do, it was worth at least some effort. The Clean Air Act is a much less than ideal means for regulating greenhouse gases, and this will hopefully create future legal problems for EPA. It is my view that the Obama administration will not give up this lone area of leverage through fiat regulation by EPA, perhaps because it is completely committed to the world warmest effort and will do almost anything to keep from doing anything which would slow it down. It also seems to me that they are taking a very dangerous route in terms of how it will turn out at the polls. That continues to amaze me, but that's what they're doing. There are a number of ways that I think Congress can and the courts can attempt to rein in EPA. George Allen this morning mentioned several of them. I think they should all be looked at, but I'm not too optimistic that at least in this Congress there are enough votes to manage to make any of these things happen. I won't go through them all in interest of time. There are a number of longer term problems which may in the end prove to be of more importance. Not that trying to rein in EPA is not an important problem. Previous administrations have tried to minimize adverse economic effects of environmental regulations as well as fallout in terms of, I think, politics. This is how EPA managed to get as much power and influence as it did, in my opinion, because it was easier for Congress to say, well, we'll just leave it to the administration, but no one foresaw that EPA would be, and the administration would be taken over by the far left in terms of the environment. The Obama administration has exactly the opposite approach. They want to use EPA to change public and possibly congressional behavior regardless of the cost. And unknown to me in any previous administration under which I have served, the administration has determined what the science is. In the past, well, there's some people who say this and some people say that, and we should reach a balanced view. But this administration, at least in the environmental areas, knows the answer and is not willing to, I think, compromise on that. So We have a very new situation at EPA, and my question is how we might go about reducing the risks of something similar to this in the future. It is my view that there is nothing that's going to stop the current administration from using bad science if it continues to insist on doing so. I'm aware, of course, that there's a much larger set of problems which have been addressed by, I think, Richard Lindzen and many others. And these need to be addressed, but I'm going to try to talk only about EPA and some other related agency. Up until now, I don't think it ever entered anybody's mind that it might be a good idea to try to insulate EPA from direct control by the current administration. But there are other regulatory agencies where that is the case, and I'm wondering whether that might be useful here too. At the very least, I think that Congress must insist that EPA carry out independent analyses and not rely on outside assessments, in this case, the UN. It is my view that there is a need to remove the strong financial and other incentives for EPA managers and other senior civil service employees to follow the what the administration wants. It's not widely known, but in the last administration, the management of EPA has obtained quite direct control over exactly how much the senior managers and also the senior analysts are paid year by year. This is on top of all the other quite direct controls that they have. It is further my view that although some of the acts under which EPA operates do require that EPA go back and look at what they've done and to assess whether the regulations are reasonable or need to be revised, that's not true of a number of important acts and subsections thereof. And we need to, I think, require that. Finally, dealing only with EPA here, I fear that EPA has lost sight of the most important aspect of the scientific method, which is that science needs to be based on observable reality, not on peer review. What we have in this case is that there are enough warmus in the world, in the scientific world, that you can get a favorable peer review for almost anything that is written on that side. So I don't think it proves whether the ideas being reviewed are good or bad. It's just one one point of view. Okay, there are many long-term reforms needed elsewhere. I would advocate the end of the new National Climate Service just created. The last thing we need is for the federal government to speak with one voice on climate science. There needs to be a split of responsibility for, I think, gathering and analyzing climate data to reduce the, between that activity and its interpretation in order to reduce the temptation of one influencing the other. My view is that we need to get government out of the choice of, that is government at the federal level and at the state legislative level, out of deciding which particular type of energy choices should be made. I'm going to skip more rapidly. One of the reasons I think we got ourselves into this mess is that most of the money's coming from the federal government, and R&D decisions have been somewhat, I think, captured by a particular viewpoint, and somehow we have to avoid that in the years to come. That's going to be very difficult. And furthermore, I would advocate that if it's possible to do it, that the U.S. not fund the UN for climate change efforts or EPA. Okay, on the next two slides, I've tried to outline eight significant assumptions that the warmists have made. The first three are listed on this slide and have been widely discussed, and I will not talk about them at all, since most of the rest of the conference is dealing with them. Whoops. If you know how to make this.
Where was it? No, it's right here.
2B, right. There. Maybe I hit the wrong button. There are five, according to my count, even more dubious assumptions that the warmists have made, and which most of the skeptics have ignored, not completely. One is that it is realistic for humans to rapidly and drastically reduce greenhouse gas levels. The best evidence we have is that if they work at it really hard, they can keep greenhouse gases from going up. But bringing them down is going to be very difficult. Assumption number five is that a new UN consensus can be reached. I don't think that's the case, and it was amply illustrated in Copenhagen. There seems to be a viewpoint among the warmists that it's both desirable and feasible for countries such as the United States to pay large amounts to less developed countries with little or no strings. I don't think the history of U.S. foreign aid supports that view. There seems to be a view that if a new consensus should be reached, that the countries that sign on to it would actually implement what they agreed to do. This certainly is not the history of Kyoto. And finally, the most daring assumption is that if all the things they advocate were to take place, that it would reduce global warming so as to avoid a 2% increase in temperatures. As has been widely discussed, there is extreme uncertainty as to the climate sensitivity factors. Climate models are extremely inaccurate, and it's impossible, given current models and assumptions, to reach any such conclusions. Thank you very much. You can find more information on my website.